following is an unrehearsed interview with Clayton Klingenfuss. I'll try to get better on that. For the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview is being conducted at Newcastle, Kentucky on July the 8th, 1987 by John Klee. To begin, why don't you tell me a little bit about your background, your training, how you got into this position.
All right. I'm a native of Oldham County. I was born and raised on a farm, dairy farm, tobacco farm. I went to Crestwood Grade School, Oldham County High School, graduated in 64. Graduated in 1968 from the University of Kentucky.
What did you study there?
Political science and history.
Okay.
And secondary education. I was actively involved in 4-H growing up and FFA, so much of my life centered around rural organizations. And my father and my uncle would rotate back and forth on the district ASCS committee. And so I've grown up with some knowledge and understanding of the tobacco program.
Mm-hmm.
After graduating from the University of Kentucky, I went to Asbury Theological Seminary for a year and a half, and then transferred to Lexington Theological Seminary, where I got my Doctor of Ministries degree in 1975.
And then what happened from there?
Okay, let me talk about my church background a little bit. I grew up in the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. In my childhood, in my teenage years, we moved to Centerfield, which is a Methodist community, and attended the Methodist church there, and went into the Methodist church as a pastor in college, and pastored mm-hmm. Pace Chapel United Methodist Church in Anderson County, a very small farm area that was heavily dependent on tobacco. And then 2 years in Olive Branch United Methodist Church in Shelby County. Spent 6 months as Associate Minister of Youth at Versailles United Methodist Church. Been 17 months at the Methodist home at Versailles as a house parent, and I've been here in Newcastle since November of 1970 as pastor of this church.
Oh, I see. Did some of your college and pastoring overlap then?
Yes, it did, quite a bit. But I've been here at Newcastle Christian Church for 17 years and pastored a congregation that's has many farmers in it. We're a teacher church. We're a church that has some small businessmen in it also.
Mm-hmm. How important is farming to this area?
Farming is almost everything. Mm-hmm. This dependence upon farmers and farm revenue in this area is, I mean, we would just drop and blow away if it wasn't for our tobacco and dairy, mm-hmm. beef cattle industry here. In Eminence there's some small industry, light industry. There's some sense that Henry County has some bedroom community nature to it, especially towards the western part of the county. But predominantly it's agrarian.
Mm-hmm. You were raised on a tobacco farm, and you know there's a lot of tobacco farmers here in the area. In as part of that agricultural community, how important is tobacco to the agricultural community?
Tobacco is it's hard to say exactly what all tobacco means to this area. For some farmers, it's their total livelihood,
mm-hmm.
and they will go to the to the bank or to the PCA or to the FMHA and get money necessary for putting out their tobacco crop. And that included in that will be cost of living that year, mm-hmm. with anticipation that at the end of the tobacco season they'll be able to pay all that back and be able to make plans for the next year's crop.
Mm-hmm.
And for those people, tobacco's all in all. that many of the people here have never worked in what they call public work jobs. They've always relied on their small farm incomes as their livelihood, and there's quite a scramble to get leased tobacco nowadays, because there's people, instead of, as tobacco, the tobacco prices fall, instead of dropping out of tobacco, they think, well, we'll just lease more tobacco, and so they get more and more lease, and there's quite a bit of competition lately for that tobacco lease poundage. There's, for some people, it's everything. For others, it is a crop that provides probably the only profit on the farm. It is enough. They may have dairy, and they may have beef cattle, and that sort of pays the bills. But the profit is in the tobacco, and when that tobacco check comes in, then that's a time of celebration.
Right.
There's others that would view themselves, would call themselves dairy farmers or beef farmers, but they are very dependent on the tobacco to make the payment to the FMHA and to really pay off the land itself.
Tobacco then is something, it's an income they can plan on because of the quotas and so forth.
That's right. Another factor too is we have a lot of people who own small acreages who work in factory work or in other public work jobs, and then they have tobacco on the side as extra income, and yet it's very important, because everybody becomes dependent on tobacco eventually. That income, if you stay with it long enough, you become dependent. You know it's going to be there at the end of the year.
Sure. The demographics of this area, are there quite a few older people that live in the community?
Mm-hmm. Yes, this community, it's not as bad as an Appalachian community where you find a great number of elderly people. There's a broad range of ages in Henry County, but I'd say that we tend to be towards the on the older side. I'm sure this would be available somewhere, but I don't know what those figures are.
The reason I was wondering is I wondered if there were older, maybe retired people that had that tobacco poundage on their small farm or whatever, and had that lease that they were depending on.
This is the normal trend, is that as people get older, they lease it out. Sometimes they lease it out to family members, and sometimes they lease it out to neighbors or to others that come asking for it. And after a while, it becomes much more profitable for them to lease it out than to try to raise it or to manage it.
Right. As a pastor, pastoring farmers and others, of course, but what kinds of special challenges, before I get to that, what kind of people are these to deal with? As compared to, you were in Versailles and worked in other areas, and as a student, had lots of contacts.
Okay, these people are very proud people.
Mm-hmm.
They're very self-sufficient. They pride themselves on self-sufficiency. They have a real hostility toward those who they see as being on the dole, and they are very much caught up in the Protestant work ethic. Mm-hmm. They believe that if you work hard enough, you'll make it, which some of them, especially the younger people, are beginning to get very cynical about that attitude. They have a very strong sense of an importance of work and industry. These are people that sometimes fall in two camps. You've got those who are whose farms are paid for. They're secure.
Mm-hmm.
They're comfortable with the situation as it is. And then you have a number of young farmers who are struggling just to make it, always living on the brink of bankruptcy, who every decision they make on the farm is a matter of life or death of their enterprise. Sometimes the older landed farmers do not have real good understanding or sympathy with these other young farmers. So it, you know, there's tends to be some polarization over those issues, and and so you have two different trains of thought growing up simultaneously. Everyone basically holding to that concept, if you work hard enough, you'll make it. Sometimes that is a source of pride. I have made it. I've worked hard. I have this to show for it. Others say, I am working hard. I'm trying to make it, but everything seems to be going against me.
How are they to deal with, how those people to deal with as a pastor? How are they?
Again,
I mean, there's a stereotype of rural people that, and you know, the in history and in literature, that, you know, the country is closer to God and those kind of things.
Their self-sufficiency, they're feeling that they're out there making it, is often couched in terms, well, God is the one we depend on. We depend on him for the rain, we depend on him for the weather.
Sure.
Factors, the climate factors have to be there, and we know that. But, it's always that but, you know, we've got to work at it. We've got to make it go. And there's a sense that God helps those who help themselves, and that attitude is pretty prevalent throughout our society here. And to that extent, it's not such a they don't think of themselves as relying on the Lord when it comes down to the nitty gritty of actually doing the work.
No, they do.
It's we've got to get out there and get it, you know. And right. I would like to see a little more reliance upon the Lord and a little more appreciation of what he does for us than this self-sufficiency. Yeah.
Right.
Although, you know, there's a great source of industry because
sure.
of that.
This, when I was looking for someone, I had, I was interested in dealing with people that, in religion, that deal with farmers and how they address the moral issue and those kind of things. And when I found the name of this Fitzgerald, I called him, and out of the whole state, the first person he thought of to talk to was the fellow up in Henry County. What kinds of efforts have you made to deal pastorally with people and you know, that live a rural life?
Okay, well, first of all, let me say I rely a lot on my past experience and my identification with people.
Mm-hmm.
Out of who I am springs forth that ministry to some extent. I don't want to go into too much detail on that except to say that I had once thought of going into county extension work or into some field of agriculture to help my people.
Mm-hmm.
I was called to the ministry, and yet I've always held on to that sense that I want to be involved in ministering to those who are in a rural setting, and that's what I've basically devoted my life to this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I rely a great deal on my past experiences to help pastor these people. I've been involved in establishing programs that I hope will be effective in meeting some needs. We've, I and a number of people in the community have organized the Community Farm Alliance for the purpose of trying to come to grips with the problems that we're facing in the marketplace, trying to come to grips with the emotional, economic, spiritual questions that are raised by the present crisis that the small family farmer is facing. My church has been very supportive of this. I initiated it. The congregation has backed me on it. We host the CFA in our fellowship hall once a month, and the church allows me time to invest in this particular work. I'm also on the Rural Life Issues Task Force of the Kentucky Council of Churches. And in this organization, we are trying to put together workshops around the state that sensitizes farmers, mental health professionals, other caregivers with the problem that the small family farmer is facing. Not to look at it in just economic and demographic terms, but to look at it as the personal crisis it is to the individual farmer and to his family.
Let me bring a little bit more out from you on those two organizations. The Community Farm Alliance is mostly a Henry County-based group.
There's two areas. We're almost like two pockets. One is the Henry County, the other is Marion County. We have some communication between each other. We're very much alike in our dependence upon tobacco and, and small family farming. We're geographically pretty much separated, and our histories are somewhat different, but we are tied together with that those elements that I spoke of earlier.
Now, you said you meet once a month. Just you bring farmers in. What do you plan your agendas? I mean, how you're going to approach this problem?
Well, sometimes I don't think we're very effective in bringing farmers in. Basically, it's a group of farmers and community people who have a great valuing of the small family farm. We're basically a pretty small group. We'd like to be larger, but we go with what we have. I think it's a fairly influential group in terms of overall state and federal policies that we're able to influence, that we feel some strength in the group on being able to do that. We got some very articulate people, some very well-educated people working with us in this program, and that are farmers who have some ability to articulate the position of the small family farmer.
Yeah, I noticed at one point, I don't know, this was maybe over a year ago, where a meeting was held, evening forum, and I think there were some people from Kentucky State.
Right. We involved a number of experts in finance, and they came and held a workshop for us here to deal with the problems of the present economic circumstances of the farmer, to deal with the problems of farm foreclosure.
So in that way, you were trying to educate people.
Yeah, it's an education process. We realize that those who need it the most aren't going to be there.
Sure.
There's, again, the pride and self-sufficiency of farmers oftentimes keeps them from the very thing they need. We found that it's the farm wife who is most willing to address the real issue of the economic crisis. I found that from my own personal counseling.
Sure.
I found it from my involvement in the group and other people's experience.
You also take political kinds of actions?
We're involved in, we're promoting the Harkin Gephardt bill in the Congress right now, hoping that this bill will alleviate some of the stresses that the farmers are facing right now.
This deals with imports.
The import and import quotas, and it deals with, I like the Harkin bill because it is a program that doesn't rely on the government to subsidize it, but essentially to establish what we have in the tobacco program right now on other commodities, so that we're not outproducing ourselves to death, and to establish some sense of quotas within our farming enterprises.
Hang on just a minute. You mentioned this Kentucky Life Issues Task Force of the Kentucky Council of Churches. I have several questions dealing with that. Tell me about that task force first.
Okay, we were organized out of the Kentucky Commission on Hunger, which is one of the sub branches of the Kentucky Council of Churches. And the task force on hunger felt a need for a subcommittee that could look into the problem of the small family farmer. They felt like that the decline of the small family farmer means that production of food is going to be in the hands of fewer and fewer people who could use that power to raise the price of food and control the destiny of the nation.
Sure.
Which is a real concern of mine also. They felt like that there was a great deal of stress and a real sense of tragedy in the loss of the small family farm on the basis of the individuals who are caught up in that crisis.
Sure.
And they now, who were once the producers of food, for some of them, they themselves are suffering hunger. And
right.
So to deal with that, this Rural Life Issues Task Force was established to come to grips with that.
Mm-hmm. What have you all, met? Have you been working?
Mm-hmm.
What are your goals?
We've been meeting for about a year and mm-hmm. a year and a half, I guess. I've been a part of it since March of 86.
Mm-hmm.
And our goals are to establish, establish some sense of empathy, understanding on the part of ministers, mental health professionals, caregivers, and throughout mm-hmm. the state, to influence the development of legislative programs that would be beneficial to the farmers in Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
and to influence federal legislation too. Also, we're hoping to establish some response teams in various areas to meet emotional, physical, but sort of take a holistic approach to the problems that small family mm-hmm. farmers are facing.
Yeah. That brings me to the next question, which kind of deals with has religion, church organizations, Kentucky Council churches, I don't want to,
mm-hmm.
single out any certain group, but has religion kind of been slow to respond to this problem? Could they do more? Is it a low priority? What's your sense of that?
I've been really happy with the way in which the denominations and judicatories of those denominations have responded to the need. I think mm-hmm. that ironically it's the large, seemingly distant denominations who have rallied to the cause of the small family farmer
mm-hmm.
rather than the local congregations.
Mm-hmm.
Many local congregations are very slow to respond to these needs of farmers. We've seen statistics and that are related to different interviews of people who have suffered farming problems, especially out in Iowa and Midwest,
yeah, right.
and they always list the church in order of helping way below the banks
mm-hmm.
and lawyers and sometimes the very people who are the adversaries
right.
of the small family farmer. The church is rated below them.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a sense that the church or the local congregation has stood in judgment of their failures.
Mm-hmm.
And so they felt like the church would judge them. Whether or not that's an accurate portrayal of those individual congregations or not, I don't know. I think not, but
mm-hmm.
but I think that people have that perception.
Feeling,
mm-hmm.
right.
I think that we have been slow to take the initiative in ministering to these people. Again, I think it's out of the fact that we as ministers and congregation are afraid that we're going to rob people of their pride and dignity. And again,
mm-hmm.
farmers are that I know are very, very proud people and want to maintain their dignity even in the midst of great hardship.
Sure.
And sometimes their masking of their problems has caused the churches to be unresponsive.
I guess you kind of answered this, but a pastor and a congregation could take the approach that, this is really outside our realm.
Mm-hmm.
This is not something we do.
Oh, yeah.
This really doesn't deal with faith and so forth.
I would say, especially among more conservative churches,
mm-hmm.
which view their ministry in terms of just proclaiming the gospel only and
mm-hmm.
looking at it very narrowly. But I think among moderate to liberal churches, there's a much more empathy for the
mm-hmm.
human tragedy that's involved.
Right. Let me talk about some specifics with you and your dealings. You have had to counsel people that are having trouble
mm-hmm.
on the farm. How does that? What form does that counseling take? How do you approach that? What kinds of problems do you face?
Well, I take a very low profile on this.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I want to do is establish in the community that I cared, mm-hmm. that I was involved in organizations that cared. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing that for my self-promotion. I'm doing it because unless people know that I am a willing ear,
they won't
come.
Right.
And I can't go to them and say, I understand you're having problems. And they say, who told you that?
Mm-hmm.
So I know better than to approach it that way. But I've had, and usually it's the minister's wife, the farmer's wife who comes to me,
uh-huh.
and will say, we are really in distress. Mm-hmm. What can we do? We're facing foreclosure. Who can we turn to for help?
Mm-hmm.
What resources do you have available?
Mm-hmm.
In some of the most confidential settings and situations revolve around this particular kind of issue, this mm-hmm. this concern about farm foreclosure.
Yeah.
And people are much less willing to talk about that than they are marital problems, and much more concerned that you're going to violate their confidentiality uh-huh. over that than probably any yeah. other issue.
Huh.
Even though it's probably a matter of record, public record, more than a lot of other problems.
What have you set up a network of contacts in the community? What kinds of people do you call and say, well, what can we do here? I mean, do you know bankers and
yeah.
PCA people?
We know bankers, yeah, mm-hmm. lawyers. Mm-hmm. I know who I can call on who would give good counsel to small farmers.
Mm-hmm.
We have a hotline at the Community Farm Alliance funds,
mm-hmm.
and we have a young lady who's with legal aid
mm-hmm.
who answers that phone for us and very knowledgeable about farm issues,
mm-hmm.
farm foreclosure questions, and understands the bankruptcy laws and I have turned to her on one occasion and found her to be very a very good help and very good encouragement to the people that I was working with and that I was working with. As far as networking with FMHA, there's a real resistance to that, and they don't like people meddling in their business,
right.
and they don't, and they feel like we're watchdogging, and I guess we are to some extent. But we've had some real frustrations with the bureaucracy and,
mm-hmm.
and found them to make errors and
mm-hmm.
and to use poor judgment sometimes in the denial of loans.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're hoping to establish better rapport with them in the future. We do have, through Farm Aid, we have $1,000 that's made available through the Rural Life Issues Task Force, and $1,000 made available through the Community Farm Alliance, both from Farm Aid, and it's for direct needs. I can turn to people in either of those organizations and come up with $100, and that's the limit, that's
right.
ceiling that Farm Aid people put on it, to meet the needs of utilities or rent
short run
stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, for some of these farmers, that's just a little drop of bucket for what they need. So,
sure.
It does let people know we care,
mm-hmm.
and that farmers are there to help farmers, and there's a real sense of caring there among those organizations. Our church gives direct gives direct aid to people, not just farmers, but many people who are distressed, farmers being one of those
groups.
Uh-huh.
What about counseling? Of course, you, I guess, do some of that as a pastor.
Mm-hmm.
Are you community health people?
Yeah. Let me have that in. Tom Gardner, our community mental health professional here, does a really good job. Is well respected among mm-hmm. many people. And I will network with him whenever people are willing to do that. One of the problems is that rural people have a real,
right.
What's the word, distrust of mental health.
Mm-hmm.
They'll much sooner turn to a minister
sure.
and feel some resolution of their problem with a minister than they will with
right.
mental health professional, they feel that they're going to be labeled as nuts if they go there. I know that that's true across the boards of society in general. I used to be a mental health professional for about, I spent a year with, while I was a student with Tri County, the Tri County Mental Health Services here. So I'm able to see some things from their particular perspective too.
This is side two of a tape with Clayton Klinkenfuss. We were talking about the kinds of helps and so forth people have. I want to go back and deal some specific issues, and one of them I haven't gotten into yet, which I guess is a big one, and one of the reasons I wanted to talk to someone in the ministry. Tobacco, of course, has become a moral issue. I guess it always, to some people, has been a moral issue. And of course, you go to these, you're in meetings with other ministers, Kentucky Council churches and so forth, and the state is very dependent. We've already talked about the importance of tobacco for these people. How do you look at that? How do you approach that?
I go back to my background. As a disciple, tobacco was never a moral issue. Our denomination's moderate, so liberal enough that's never been raised as to whether or not a person is a good Christian or not. Going into the Methodist church, in a conservative Methodist church, the first time I ever heard that smoking was immoral, and I was a little astonished at that particular position. I never smoked. My family never smoked. I have 43 Klinkenfusses, and out of the 43, I think two smoke.
Uh-huh.
And we've raised tobacco for years.
Sure.
But it's not a moral issue. It's I think it's a matter of health and economics more than anything. It's cost to smoke.
Sure.
But most of the people, I think that dealing with it as a religious issue, the conservative churches, the holiness churches, of course, have always taken a stand that it was immoral to smoke.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was bad witness to smoke, and it was bad for your health.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last few years, I've seen the liberal churches get on the bandwagon on that, not dealing with it so much as sinful as it is health issues. And and now many of the liberal churches are also trying to encourage people to quit smoking for their own health situation. And in our church, in 1970, I would say that of the adults, probably 40% smoked. Right now, it's probably 10%. I've never preached on smoking,
right.
And like I said earlier, I don't consider it a moral issue. I am concerned about their health, and I'd like to see them quit on that basis. Now, this is really sounds incongruent with the fact that we're very much dependent upon tobacco here in Henry County. There are some people in my church who are hostile to those who do not smoke, and I've had people take up smoking because they were under a great deal of social pressure to smoke.
Right.
If they're going to raise tobacco, they better start smoking, or they're going to industry is going to hurt and suffer.
Uh-huh.
And yet, we're very aware of the fact that tobacco raises some moral issues in terms that maybe the more conservative churches have not addressed, and that is that it's taken number one, number two, three class land out of food production and put it into production of something that is harmful to the health of the person, to the community. And some of us have grieved over that. But we're also very aware in the religious community that you just can't take tobacco from these people cold turkey.
Right.
That it's something that that is a part of our culture. It's part of our economic superstructure of this area that cannot be removed. We've tried some alternative crops. I was personally involved in trying to establish the cucumber industry here. I called in some people from Paramount Foods to ask them if they would extend to us contracts in this area for cucumbers, and they were most happy to do that. Price was not very good, but we had many people to undertake it, and we had maybe 50 farmers growing cucumbers in various degrees of intensity. Uh-huh. Some made good profit, almost as good as tobacco, mm-hmm. but the amount of labor involved in it was very discouraging for most, and impractical, and just not economically feasible for many. Right. And there's just a limited number of people that grow cucumbers anyway.
Sure.
So tobacco has just been our thing, and it would be a great social economic upheaval for it not to be here. And I think you have to weigh that in light of the moral issues involved. The catastrophic tragedy to the individual farm families has to be weighed against the health issues. Many of the people that I know who are very strong supporters of the tobacco program and tobacco production here have shared with me their concerns about the production of tobacco on the basis of this particular issue. Mm-hmm. But it always takes the back burner to the economics.
Right now, the bottom line is there's just nothing to replace tobacco as far as the money is concerned.
Right. I mean, it's almost immoral for us to grow more soybeans and more corn because those crops erode the soil so badly. Mm-hmm. It's not needed. It's piling up in the warehouses.
Yeah.
And it's unfeasible for us to grow more vegetables. And if we grew more vegetables, we would just be robbing people in Trimble County and other places who are depending on it and who know more about it than we do. It's frightening to think about any alternative to tobacco because it's going to have economic ramifications for somebody
elsewhere,
Right.
Plus some of our land and small plots, there's no way to use that small plot and generate as much
income. Right. Oh, it's just, I just can't even conceive of anything producing that much money. Except marijuana, and some people have turned to that as an alternative crop.
What the program, the tobacco has, people's quotas have been cut, the amount of money they get for tobacco has been cut. Have you seen an impact, say, in your church collections in the community on those things? Have there been some bankruptcies here in the area?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bankruptcies. There's been several farm bankruptcies in the area, people on the verge of bankruptcy, mm-hmm. and in part due to the fact that when they began their farming enterprise, they anticipated that the price of tobacco would stay the same or rise,
right.
and they didn't realize that there was any chance in the future that it would be curtailed.
Right.
So that's a problem. Mm-hmm. It is economic development in Newcastle has been very slow in the last few years. 15 years ago, when I was here, there was a lot more services, quite a few more services. More of the storefronts were filled with stores. We had a very successful restaurant at one time. We now have a restaurant that's struggling. It's been recently established in the last 3 months. But we went 4 years, 5 years without a restaurant at all. County seat town.
County seat.
And people in a county seat town will go to a grocery store and get bread and bologna and make a sandwich. But the restaurant did not feel like it could make it.
Gee.
We have. I think in the church, it's hard for us to know exactly how much we've suffered from that. Uh-huh. We've grown numerically in this church, and we have a number of teachers as our base. We have 20 teachers in this church.
I see.
So our financial base is not so threatened by it. Some of the smaller churches in the rural areas, they're pretty well threatened by it, and it has hurt them.
What about land values? These farms that were foreclosed.
This is I think one of the more terrible things. Of course, it has more far-reaching effects than a lot of people are aware of. Many people in this area have bought land at $1,000 to $1,200 an acre, and now when they tried to go to the FMHA loan money to buy the land at $1,200 an acre, so they've bought the land. They go back to FMHA for their production loans, and they said, "Well, you can't make it." I said, "Well, why?" I said, "Well, your land's only worth $600 an acre. We can't loan you money at the full value of your farm." And they said, "Well, we were counting on it." Mm-hmm. "I'm sorry, the land values have fallen." Mm-hmm. And there's really no sensitivity from FMHA about that. You know, the tough luck is the sort of the attitude you get.
I see.
And they said, "Well, you're going to fail." I've had one of those small farmers that I've talked with went back to FMHA expecting the loan without any problem. Mm-hmm. They said, "You're going to fail."
Lack of sensitivity you were talking about with some of the organizations.
Yeah, and they said in this particular situation with this farmer, he said, "Well, I need that to put out my crop." And they said, "Well, we've looked at all your figures and all, and we just don't think you can make it." This man came. Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, he was hospitalized for 2 weeks in a psychiatric hospital because of the depression that developed from that.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, when he got out of the hospital, some part-time work in an organization in the area opened up, and he was able to get some work there. He's not relying on his farm income as his sole income anymore. To his chagrin, he'd love to be in full-time farming,
sure.
He just cannot do it.
Yeah. Is that another thing that's happened? You mentioned, being a bedroom community, and people held on their farms as a lifestyle, but they're working in Frankfurt or elsewhere.
They're trying to get them. One of the problems I've found among middle-aged farmers, farmers who are, let's say, in their 50s, I know of a situation where a farmer and his brother, two farmers, brothers, left dairying because of anti-tobacco, because they could get out through the dairy buyout.
Yeah.
And so they're waiting for their check from the government to come. It's been 6 months late, and they are very hurting very bad financially.
Uh-huh.
They sought jobs in the public sector.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were amazed. Eventually, he settled for a janitor's job.
Mm-hmm.
And not because he didn't have the skills to do something else, but they say, "Well, you're 50 years old. I've got all these young people that can come in and do what you're doing." And it's very demeaning to him, because here's a man that was able to run a large, successful enterprise,
mm-hmm.
who now was not viewed as being fit for employment.
Gee.
Now, that's not true among a lot of some other farmers. My brother left farming after getting into economic problems, was able to get on with a steel company here and has risen into the ranks pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And many farmers do that. They young farmers who leave farming eventually find themselves very employable in the public sector, because they have demonstrated management skills and those values, and the sense the work ethic is very much in demand, and that's a real threat to a lot of non-farm people searching for jobs, because it has stressed the market for jobs quite a bit in this area.
Yeah.
Did I address that problem?
Yeah, I think so. What about, I don't know the demographics of this area very well. I see black citizens here in the area. Are there still black farmers around, or have they mostly taken the brunt of it? Or
In Henry County,
mm-hmm.
I don't even know of a black farmer in Henry County. Let me think a minute. Yeah, I know one fellow who works part-time farming and holds a public job, but man, he's over 70.
Mm-hmm.
There are no young black farmers who own land or are in the process of buying land. I've known one or two in Oldham County that own land, but they get some outside employment or are older. Some of them very successful farmers, but always want to keep their enterprises small. They're not interested in large production.
Well, we have. The reason I bring it up is there's in my area of the state there's a few black farmers that are very successful, but it's kind of a vanishing group.
It really is, and that's a really sad commentary on our society.
Mm-hmm.
But to speak of it in relation to the Henry County farming, it's not been existent here in the 17 years I've been in Newcastle.
Okay,
we have a few tenants that are black. It's funny, most of the tenant farmers in Henry County are white, probably 80% white.
I see. What kinds of ideas, for the future, have any of these, I know these groups think about that and talk about it, and you've hit on it already with alternate crops and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
What happens? What's going to happen?
Well,
and how do you plan for that?
One CFA meeting, we just about ended our meeting in total futility. We all, after talking about all the problems we were facing and all the alternatives to the future, we sat in stunned silence at our own inability to think of anything.
Mm-hmm.
We were about to close the meeting with no resolution to that issue at all.
I see.
And I don't have a real good answer to it other than to say that I think we're going to have to face the fact that many small farmers or young farmers are going to have some kind of outside employment, and farming is going to have to be a avocation and not the main vocation. I think we're going to have to face that fact that I just don't know how this nation of ours is ever going to continue to feed itself on people who have to approach farming as an avocation. But beef production, there are very few farmers that rely completely on beef production for their income anymore. They're almost all part-time people. And of course that's very true of tobacco. Tobacco relies more and more on people who have outside income. Dairying has to be a full-time enterprise.
I was going to ask you about that when you mentioned it before. Were there very many dairy farmers that took advantage of the buyout plan?
I know of several.
Uh-huh.
Let me say this. I know more that took the buyout plan than have been
in.
Foreclosed upon.
Oh, I see.
No, there's more that stayed in
than
bought out. Many people had already left before the buyout came into effect.
That seems to me to pose particular problems. You mentioned what do you do for 5 years while you're out of the dairy business?
Those people should never have hopes of getting back into
back
dairy.
I
just don't think there's any future for them to come back to milk. I think milk production is continuing to rise among the small number of farmers that are left. Those farmers get larger and larger and more efficient. I think dairying lends itself to mechanization more than some other areas of farming, especially tobacco farming. And so the smaller numbers of farmers are able to handle bigger herds. And so those small farmers that got out, I think they're going to find it almost impossible to compete when they try to come back in 5 years.
The couple of issues that you mentioned, we've talked about family farms, and most of our farms, and I think in this whole region of the state, are really family farms, but they're not your 40 acres and a mule type farm, which some people might have a vision of. There's lots of family farms that are big operations.
Mm-hmm.
Is there really a distinction there anymore between a family farm and a bigger operation.
That's something I find myself always grappling with, trying to come up with a definition of the family farm, especially the small family farm.
Sure.
My family operates 209 acres in Oldham County.
Mm-hmm.
They have a gross income of around $150,000. We would be considered a moderate farm, I guess, on
right.
a national scale. It is a family enterprise. I mean, it is owned and operated by my father and my brother.
Mm-hmm.
There are those who are trying to make it as farmers on 150 acres and full time. But they struggle. They constantly just run ahead of the foreclosure all the time, and they're becoming more and more aware of the fact that they better start getting some training or getting some other profession in mind, because they don't feel like they're going to be able to stay with it. We don't see hardly any industrial-sized farms. I mean, the large.
Right.
We have one truck farm over on Sunnyside Road that is owned by a corporation,
mm-hmm.
but it's very unusual. We see a lot of farmers leasing up large quantities of land and producing large quantities of corn,
mm-hmm.
knocking down fence rows and plowing across grassy waterways with no regard for the land at all. And yet, even though they may farm thousands of acres of corn, they're always running just ahead of foreclosure themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They are always afraid that if they, you know, if everybody overproduces, the price of corn is going to go down, or you're going to have a drought and lose it all. And the fear of that drives them to plow up more and more land. FMHA or their creditors say you've got to produce more and more in order to pay this back. So the debt itself becomes a slave driver, taskmaster to those people.
That brings up, you've mentioned it in passing a couple times, this concern for the land, which, you know, I guess in a historical vein, the small family farmer I guess there are different results, but because they were small and because they used animal fertilizer, animal manure for fertilizer and so forth, they were pretty sound ecologically. But is that another issue that you're very concerned with, is the ecology of farmland? And
yes, I really have a real concern for it. I don't see that concern shared by many farmers, though, of any size.
Uh-huh.
You know, sure, they use a lot. Most farmers of all sizes, I think, use manure to
sure.
fertilize with, but all farmers of all sizes also use commercial fertilizers.
Right.
So. And farmers of all sizes use all sorts of chemicals,
sure.
and most of them have a disregard for that. I mean, they don't, not a disregard, but they don't put that on the list of priorities of things to be concerned
right.
about. But I will say this: the small family farmer is much more concerned about rotation of crops and making sure that he keeps his terraces in place,
mm-hmm.
and his grassy waterways grassy,
mm-hmm.
Will plow on contour, will keep more land in pasture, and will observe more of those kind of passive ecological
mm-hmm.
strengths than large farmers, the big ones that plow from fence row to fence
right.
row. But as far as I see small farmers using the herbicides and pesticides and the
sure.
And the fertilizers just as broadly as the large farmers. I don't know that there's much difference in that. Wendell Berry, you know, is a resident of our county, and has spoken very articulately on that. A number of us, many of us in the CFA, have great respect for Wendell's views on things,
mm-hmm.
but tragically, in this county, people look at Wendell with cynicism or
right.
with a sense that, you know, he's out of touch with reality.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's tragic, because he's got some good things to say
sure.
to us.
There's a couple more questions I have. What do you say to those politicians and so forth that said, well, the small markets were eaten up by the big markets, and there's no more small restaurants. There's, mm-hmm. you know, the chains. Why don't we just let the small family farm go?
Well, I know that that is the trend right now in America across mm-hmm. the board. I mean, it's obvious. Sure. You see large oil companies getting eaten up by larger oil companies, or right. large Teddy Roosevelt would be appalled.
Uh-huh.
We're living in an age of monopolies again. Mm-hmm. But that's a real concern for me and many people. We see banks. This is for farmers. This is a real fear.
Sure.
That the small local banks being consumed by the larger bank, which mm-hmm. deals with them in more more in terms of their economic numbers than in terms of who they are as people.
Right.
And it comes down to the farm as well. Our fear is that the larger if the day ever comes where the Cargills and the Dreyfuses and the General Foods buy up all the small farms,
mm-hmm.
that a great deal of power, a great deal of economic force is going to be in the hands of very few, and they're going to be in the hands of people that are not going to take into consideration the needs of the local community, the needs of the individuals, needs of those who will be living on their land.
Yeah.
And we're also concerned about what that does to the human spirit, to not have that sense of accomplishment anymore.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's the issue I kind of want to finish up on. What I think that there's a general opinion that, you know, the farmer's a special kind of person, a special breed, it has a special spirit. What happens in this area, say, to young people? You've got young people in your church.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people aren't encouraging people to go into the family business, to go into farming. Certainly it's difficult to go into farming and try to pay for a farm.
Mm-hmm.
Are they leaving the community?
If anyone ever asks me whether they should go into farming or go into something else, I'd say go into something else for their own sake. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there's that. I hold hopes in the future that there will be something, but right now, mm-hmm. I don't see that there's much hope for those who want to stay on the farm. We have two vocational agriculture classes out of the high school. I see no point to it. What are we training them for? I will say that vocational agriculture has turned more to agribusiness as its direction, and I think I commend them for that. But I think to teach them to farm, it may be a little archaic because there's not going to be that big a demand for farmers even in this area in the years to come. I think for the sake of the individual, I think you're going to need an education. If they're going to be farmers, they're going to have to be college-educated farmers with some realistic ideas of how they can get financed and where their sources of capital are. They may need to face the reality that they're going to have to work for somebody else on somebody else's farm as a manager. Mm-hmm. If they want to be in farming, that may be the only
way.
We
didn't talk about tenants very much. You have a concern for tenants.
Yeah, I keep raising this concern wherever I am because I see it as a real problem here. Let me say, my wife's involved in a migrant, and mm-hmm. teaches the migrant students of the county.
Right.
Migrant, by federal definition, is those that cross county lines within a 5-year period of time.
Sure.
And so we have 75 of the children in the county that are classified as migrant. They're what we call tenants. They live on a small farm, but these people are being displaced.
Mm-hmm.
The small farmers that we're concerned about going bankrupt are also leaving these people without homes and without employment. As meager as it was, sometimes it was just they provided the house and maybe some food and maybe the milk from the cows. And that was it, and they relied on the welfare to take care of the rest of the needs. They got food stamps and maybe some AFDC money or something like that. But these people are displaced. We have a apartment complex here that's been recently built. It's third-party payee kind of arrangement with the federal government. Many of those people move into there.
Sure. check.
But these are farm people who are now finding themselves in a very almost urban kind of setting. You know,
and they've lost their lifestyle.
Yeah. They've lost their sense of purpose to life. And I think it's seen in the great alcoholism and drug problems among that particular group.
Well, at least the small family farmer usually kind of had middle class values, and their kids were educated.
Exactly.
And some of the tenants didn't have the same level of education.
That's right. And they didn't have those same values ingrained in them, and they're suffering a great deal from that. Mm-hmm. Their children particularly suffer.
Thank you.
Thank you.